Programming on KDLG is brought to you by Matrix Marine Incorporated, providing on-site diesel repair services and Volvo Penta support in Bristol Bay, with shops in Naknek at 246-3406 and in Dillingham in the PAF yard at 842-3646.
This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, May 19th. I'm your host, Dave Benninger, and we are glad to have you with us today. Coming up in the next half hour, the total sockeye forecast between Alaska and Russia is down about 18% this season. The McDowell Group's Andy Wink gives us some market analysis.
That's a pretty significant decline, and I think the expectation is that price will probably go up somewhat to offset that.
Plus, some fresh halibut hit the harbor this week.
It's just exciting when that halibut comes up off the long line and it breaks the water and you see how big that fish is.
We'll take you on a tour of the elementary school science fair and tag along with some scientists who are trying to tag along with some Aleutian terns, which seem to be on the decline.
We're hoping that if we get some birds tagged, that they'll wander around and kind of show us the neighborhood.
Those stories, plus a performance by the highly acclaimed choir from the Tenalian School in Port Allsworth, coming up after a look back at some of this week's news. The summer salmon season kicked off yesterday in Copper River with a 12-hour opener. The preliminary numbers from 130-plus deliveries say there were at least 600 Chinook and at least 10,000 sockeye landed, but Fish and Game expects that number to climb quite a bit when the rest of the reports come in. Area research biologist Stormy Hotz says the department is going lightly into the season as both the Chinook and Red Run forecasts are way down.
So we dropped a single period this first week due to concerns of a very low Chinook forecast. Looking at about a point estimate of 29,000 this year. We generally catch about 12,000, 13,000 Chinook. We have an in-river goal of 24,000, and so pretty quickly you realize that math doesn't work out.
The sockeye forecast is 1.5 million. The first Kings and Reds should land in Anchorage and Seattle this afternoon. Prince William Sound Saners, who fish pinks, should have a record size run later this season to pursue. Togiak herring officially ended Tuesday when the department closed the gill netters down. All of them had stopped fishing by last Saturday anyway, having landed a combined 1,400 tons. Wave Runner skipper Frank Woods says it was a tough season to be out there.
Started out slow, not very much fish hitting the beach on the gill net side. And then it was very little effort, only seven boats when I got there on the 2nd of May. And we only had a couple days of good fishing, the weather hit. The weather had been a factor the whole season, so in fact the last week was pretty miserable fishing with very little fish hitting shore.
The gill netters left about more than 5,000 tons on the table. The Saners landed most of their 16,000-ton quota. There's no word yet on the price. This week, residents in Equok, Newstu, and Kaliganik all said the Nooshigak River is running very low this spring.
I don't know. I've been out here 25-plus years, and it's the lowest I've ever seen it. Everybody I talked to said they'd never seen it that low. There's two concerns. One is the fuel, but the other concern is when the fishing is going to be good.
That's Richard King from Equok. The low water has already delayed one spring fuel delivery as all wait for more runoff or more rain. Alaska's legislature gaveled out of its 120-day session this week without much surprise. Governor Walker called them right back to work. A special session started Thursday morning to tackle the financial challenges facing the state. Speaker of the House Bryce Edgman from Dillingham said he was disappointed that lawmakers couldn't get everything done on time again this year, warning that layoff notices to state workers will go out in the beginning of June in case there's no budget by July 1st.
I don't think anybody wants to see pink slips go out, but I think we're definitely in that territory now. And clearly, this is the third year in a row that we have flirted with a government shutdown in Alaska, and it's very unfortunate. But then again, the challenges that are before the state are historic in nature and are very difficult.
Walker set a priority of 8 items for the legislature to work on, mostly related to the budget. All 3 of the governor's nominees to the Board of Fisheries were confirmed this week. Reed Morisky and John Jensen were reappointed to another term, and Fritz Johnson from Dillingham is now back on the board after he was dropped last year.
I'm glad this is happening. It took them a while, but I suspect they had bigger fish to fry, and I'm ready to do it again.
He will replace Sue Jeffrey of Kodiak. He and Jensen will be the only 2 commercial fishermen. on the state's Board of Fisheries. Togiak Refuge pilot biologist Kara Hilwig said this week she has identified the abundant furry brown moths that have been seen around the area. She said they are speckled green fruitworm moths.
And these moths are everywhere. I see them flying outside my office window. I see them crossing the road. They're clumped on the willow catkins. I see them lapping up the sap on the birch and alder trees around town.
Hilwig says it's hard to say why their numbers have spiked, but that it might be a short-lived aberration. And tonight, the Dillingham High School will graduate 35 seniors. The 93% graduation rate is the highest ever, according to Superintendent Danny Frazier.
I attribute it to our teachers. They really care about the students, and they really work with the students. We have a lot of after-school programs that we call credit recovery. But before a student goes into needing credit recovery, we try to get the help to them beforehand.
Commencement is scheduled for tonight at 7. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. I'm Dave Benninger. Very soon, the vanguard of a 41.5 million strong sockeye run will trickle into Bristol Bay. There's already some scuttlebutt of a few hitting some nets out by Clark's Point. This year's return to the world's largest sockeye salmon fishery is down a bit from the 2 years prior. To find out more about the projected value of this year's catch, I spoke with our friend Andy Wink this morning. Wink is a senior seafood analyst with the McDowell Group and publishes the twice-a-year market analysis commissioned by the BBRSDA. Well, good morning, Andy. Good to speak with you again. It's been since Pacific Marine Expo, I think, that I saw you last, which has given our markets time to do what they do, and that's what we want to talk about today. What can you say about how the sockeye product moved over the past year?
It moved very well. We had two very large harvests, the largest that we've seen in the last 20 years, back-to-back the last couple seasons. And, you know, usually when that happens, you know, sometimes markets struggle to absorb that, and there can be inventory left over, which, you know, will usually drag on prices in following years. But as we come off these big seasons, all the anecdotal reports and all the data that we've seen says that, you know, we don't really have an inventory problem. The market absorbed these large harvests very well, and that indicates that there's pretty healthy demand. You know, the demand has grown quite a bit. So that's really good news. It's a good sign. And unfortunately, the forecast is down this year because this is kind of one of those years, I think, where we could, you know, we could use even more fish.
Let me ask you about that because yeah. I know that you look beyond Bristol Bay. You look beyond Alaska. You're watching the Russia catch and the worldwide salmon catch. What do you see overall? How much product will hit the market between all the major fisheries by next fall?
Yeah, so the forecast for Russia, for Russian sockeye, is pretty similar to what they did the previous year. And with Bristol Bay down, I think that's equating to about a 23% decline in the Alaska sockeye forecast. When we look at what Alaska's forecast and Russia's forecast is, it's down about 18% or approximately 70 million pounds. So that's a pretty significant decline. And, I think the expectation is that, you know, price will probably go up somewhat to offset that. We've seen wholesale prices for all major sockeye products increasing in 2016. And so the momentum and the trend is definitely up.
What about our farmed competition? That's really seemed to be a major factor over the past couple of years because there were some major problems with the competitors there in Chile and Norway. What do you know about the farm supply for this year, and how will that impact the wild salmon fisheries?
Yeah, so the farm supply, farm salmon typically grows year after year, and it's usually on average between 5 to 7%. So anytime you have a reduction in production in the farmed industry, it really, you know, it feels a lot more significant. And that's what happened last year. I've seen different estimates, but basically people peg it at about 6 to 10% decline in production last year for Farm Atlantic. And so for this year, they're projecting pretty slow growth. I've seen between flat to up to 5%. And the farm salmon analysts think it's going to take, you know, that we're going to be in a period of slow growth for a few years. And that's, you know, that's translated into really high prices for farm salmon, which is good for Alaska sockeye.
Andy, what are you seeing with the strength of our dollar versus the currencies where we trade this product out to?
Overall, the dollar has been, is you know, really strengthened a lot since about 2014, 2015. And that's really hurt salmon prices for Alaska species. So that is kind of the downside, is that, you know, even though the sort of supply and demand trends are pretty well supportive for higher values, we've still got this strong dollar problem. I wish I had better news on that front. My crystal ball is not good enough to know where the value of the dollar is going to go from here.
So that's some pessimism about the value of this year's catch. But you seem to have some pretty good optimism, and I know that having looked at the various attitudes going into some of these seasons, especially 2015, when there was almost unanimous pessimism about what the market wanted out of that monster run. But it seems like upward trend, would you say, for the value of this year's catch?
I think so. I mean, it's going to take much higher prices to get the total value, if you're talking, you know, the total value of the fishery, to be more than it was last year. But I think that market conditions are very strong, and there's a lot of demand that's been built up. And I think that, you know, the quality increases, the quality improvements that have happened the last 2 years have really helped a lot in that regard, too.
Well, mostly good news on the market front. Andy Wink is a senior seafood analyst with the McDowell Group and is soon to publish his spring market analysis for the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association, and will present those findings at their annual meeting in June. Andy, good to speak with you this morning. Thanks so much for the time.
Thanks so much, Dave. Appreciate it.
Before the salmon get here, and usually just after the herring fishery out by Togiak that has so little participation or local tangible benefit. I mean, why we can't find even salted or iced herring at the dock perplexes me. A couple of dozen boats head out for halibut. Bristol Bay is not famous for its halibut, but there is a very healthy resource out there and a little quota carved out for the small boats to go after. Lately, they've been finding more and more cod on their lines, and this year can sell that too. KDLG's fisheries reporter Nick Shalino has more on this much-appreciated fresh catch.
On a cloudy May afternoon in the Dillingham Harbor, a lone fishing vessel called the Eagle II was tied to the docks. Skipper William Johnson and his crew were preparing the vessel for departure to the other side of the Nooshiegak Peninsula.
We're always anxious to get started, but we're waiting on ice.
Going out to Togiak, you said?
Yes, heading west to go get bait and do a little fishing out there, and then come back and then finish out the season down here.
Taking a lot of fuel with you, I see.
Yeah, we got to pack extra fuel. We're going a long distance, so it's best to bring extra.
Longliners like Johnson, who live in a western Alaskan community designated as part of the 4E group, are fishing a halibut quota of 58,800 pounds. A more than 1,000-pound increase from last season. Gary Klein is the regional fisheries director at the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation. He says if the quota is exceeded, it could get another increase of about 20,000 pounds.
If we come to the point as we did last year, where our local fleet caught our 4E quota, we have the ability to roll over the quota that we have in Area 4D, which is further offshore in the Bering Sea, which is what we did last year, and we ended up catching roughly 77,000 pounds.
Klein says this year, 4E longliners are also permitted to sell cod, up to one-fifth the weight of halibut on board. The emergency order from Alaska Department of Fish and Game changing this rule comes after years of fishermen reporting a huge increase in the number of cod caught out there. Klein says the increased harvests and participation from the 4-E group in recent years has helped spotlight the needs of its communities, prompting these small changes in fishing regulations, which go a long way for the people living in the region.
Our halibut fishery may seem small when comparing it to the other halibut fisheries throughout the state of Alaska. However, I feel it goes a long way for our residents that live in our surrounding communities that may not have a lot of job opportunities. And so this halibut fishery provides that opportunity or that chance to make a little more money for their families.
Klein says he expects 25 boats to fish the quota this year, 5 more than last season. Leroy Straley is one new participant in the Bristol Bay halibut fishery. He grew up in Dillingham, and after a few years of gill netting for salmon, he is working his first season as a crew member aboard the Eagle, a 4E longliner.
It is way more fun than I thought it was going to be. I mean, it's just exciting when that halibut comes up off the long line and it breaks the water and you see how big that fish is. And it's sometimes a little challenging to pull the bigger fish aboard, but we didn't lose one on our first trip, so that's exciting.
While some halibut is processed in Togiak, the best market for Dillingham-based boats is an eager public. A dozen or so people were waiting in line in the rain for the crew of the Eagle to sell some of the season's first catch.
Nice rainy day to be picking out fish.
How many fish are you picking up today?
Just one. You know, family of three, maybe around the 40-pound area.
How are you going to cook that thing?
In several different ways. You know, we do it every year. You know, 40, 50-pounder lasts us all year, so we're in good shape then.
I like it blackened. Personally, but I'm buying it for the women's shelter here in Dillingham.
What's your favorite way to cook halibut?
I think I like beer battered, fried, and with a cold beer. They go down real well, and chips too.
Cut it up and freeze it and enjoy.
The Eagle sold its first 22 halibut at $8 a pound Thursday afternoon, in addition to the cod they had on board. They were heading back out with the next tide. I'm Nick Shalino, KDLG News.
Thanks for staying tuned with us on Bristol Bay and beyond. Dillingham's elementary schoolers outdid themselves for the science fair this week. The gym was packed Wednesday with row after row of science experiments and poster board explanations. Using the scientific method, they explored everything from human senses to magnetism to plant growth. The kids themselves were on hand to explain.
I'm Alex Buholm and I'm 10 years old. I made slime. It feels, you know, like the silly putty that they sell at NNN. That's what it feels like. Well, it's a little bit dry.
My name is Marian Kupchayik, and how old am I? I am 9. So what I made is the thirsty flower. I got 2 cups and water. I dyed them red and blue. I put a flower, I cut it in half, but somehow it broke. So it's supposed to drink up the red and the blue. So it did. The blue showed up more, but the red, it only showed up a little bit.
I am Nikki Johnson, and I am 10 years old. I made an electromagnet because I like dealing with the electric things.
I'm Cassie Knutson, and I'm 9 years old. My title is a fizz inflator. The baking soda falls into the from the balloon into the vinegar, and it the pressure pushes up against the balloon, and it blows up.
My name is Jisa Ray, and I'm 10. My project is called Eyes or Tongue, and what I do is I take 3 cups, put Kool-Aid in 1, apple juice in 2, then dye one of the apple juices, ask people to taste it. See, it's like a test to see which sense they use better, their sight or their taste.
My name is Gus Bonkert, and I am in second grade. It's a thing that buoyancy. We made little boats out of modeling clay and put them in water and see how many marbles would float in it before it sank.
My name is Juliet Calvert, and I'm 6. It's how to keep the Arctic camels warm in the ice-cold water with rubble. It's fat. It insulates them.
I'm Madison Davenport. I'm 9 years old. My project is a pinhole camera, and when you put it up to your eyes and you turn on the flashlight, you can see the heart in the tissue paper, and the reason is that the rays of light travel from the flashlight to the place where it's projecting, and in our retina in the back of our eye, it forms backwards, and we see it, and our mind should raise it up. Science matters because without it, we wouldn't be able to have things like airplanes and cars.
And thanks to Avery Lill for producing that piece, as well as this next one. Where have the Aleutian terns gone? That's either a missing verse from a Pete Seeger protest song, or it's a question biologists who study seabirds have been asking because the population count in Alaska is down in recent years. Let's go with the latter. This downward trend of the Aleutian terns has these biologists wondering whether the population is declining or if they've simply lost track of their nesting grounds. Scientists with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and Oregon State University are in the Dillingham area this week to try a new strategy for getting a more accurate tern count. KDLG's Avery Lill has this report.
Kelly Nesvasil pounds stakes into the spongy tundra by the lily pond near downtown Dillingham. It's a reliable haunt for Aleutian terns, which are notoriously hard to track down.
When they come up here, I mean, they're used to making big migrations and stuff, and they just don't have a lot of site fidelity or territory fidelity. So when you're doing these counts, you know, you go to a tern colony and count the number of birds, it can be really variable based on the time of day, the time during the season, just they may choose to go to one colony one year and another colony next year.
Even as this wildlife biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game anchors a bow net, a handful of terns wheel overhead, cackling to each other and swooping low over the pond. Nesvasil's bow net is a spring trap, so it's an oval ring with a net stretched across it. She folds the ring in half so that it forms a crescent. With the press of a button on her remote control, it springs back into its oval shape. If one of the seabirds were standing within the net's circumference, it would be trapped, but not harmed. There are decoys around the traps to make them visible to researchers, and a Bluetooth speaker singing out tern calls to attract the birds.
That was a brief recording of Aleutian tern, Anika Prion, Leviticus, recorded on June 20th, 2000.
Once they catch a tern, they'll put a radio tag on its leg and release it. It's standard procedure for nesting terns, but the team is actually trying something new for this species. They're tagging terns before they nest.
The hope is if we catch them before they nest, then we might be able to find new colony sites or places that we didn't know about, and that can help us kind of put into perspective the other colony counts as well.
Aleutian terns only nest in Alaska and Russia, and a steep decline in the number of nesting birds counted in the state has made it a high-priority species for ADF&G when it comes to research and stewardship. Nesvasil estimates that there are about 30,000 Aleutian terns globally. Don Lyons is an assistant professor with Oregon State University. He's been studying terns for about 20 years, and he's working with Nesvasil on her research. He puts that population count into perspective.
There are several places in Alaska where they've been known to nest for decades. But over the last few decades, the number of birds that have been seen at those colony sites has really declined. In recent years, it's only been approximately 10% of the birds that were seen in the 70s or 80s.
If it's true that terns are declining, there could be a number of contributing factors. Lyons says that since the bird count is down across the state, it's likely that the cause would be widespread, not localized.
That might suggest factors like climate and just the way climate cycles, or with the warming climate. It could be that something is happening to these birds when they migrate during the fall and winter. They migrate through the Russian Far East and Japan, China, and into Indonesia for the winter. And that could be being exposed to a lot of contaminants. There's a lot of industrial development.
But the picture is more complicated when you take into account birds that nest in Russia. As far as researchers know, terns that breed in Russia and Alaska spend time in the same places over the winter.
Talking to experts in Russia, where this bird also breeds, they believe their population is pretty stable. And so that's a bit of information. It's one of those facts that we don't understand right now.
So the goal is to cut through this Gordian knot by collecting more data.
So we're trying to do some detective work to find out if their declines at known colonies is real or whether they're just moving around. A couple ways we're trying to do that. We're trying to put out some radio tags that communicate their location to a satellite network. And we're hoping that if we get some birds tagged, that they'll wander around and kind of show us the neighborhood and hopefully show us some new colonies that we don't know about.
To maximize their week in Dillingham, the team will scout the area by plane, fly up the Wood River to Sheep Island, look for birds at Snake Lake, and check out former nesting grounds at Grassy Island. But they'll spend the majority of their time at the Lily Pond. A camouflage tent is set up near the edge of the water. That's where they watch the bonets through a spotting scope. They have 7 radio tags that they hope to attach to birds in western Alaska. If they don't use all the tags in Dillingham, they'll use them when they travel to Platinum in the coming weeks. This trip to Dillingham is early days in what promises to be a long project for researchers. Nesfacil anticipates that it will be a couple of years before they begin drawing conclusions. As with most questions of ecology, the answer to what is happening with Aleutian terns could have ramifications up and down the food chain.
They're definitely a kind of a canary in a coal mine species for the coastal environment and what changes may be going on there that might impact us.
With the help of some modern trapping and tracking technology and some old-fashioned shoe leather sleuthing, these researchers are aiming to find out how many Aleutian terns there really are in Alaska and where they're making their summer homes. The hope is that with better data, better decisions can be made about how to manage the Aleutian tern and its environment. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
Finally, on this week's show, several times we have featured the Tenalian Choir here on this program, and we want to do so again. They just returned from the state competition where they did very well, especially for a small school of less than 70 total students, K-12. Patty Allsworth is the volunteer director of the Tenalian School Singers.
I've been working with some of these kids since they were in preschool, and it's been just kind of an off-and-on program, but for the last probably 7 or 8 years, we've been doing serious choir work.
She says they practice once a week year-round, but as competition season nears, the choir gets a little more serious. Allsworth says the kids give her several hours a week of dedicated rehearsal and practice time, what she calls a huge commitment.
They have been amazing. They're just such a fun group of kids to work with. And while we were in town, they just made the whole trip fun. They sang in a park, and they sang in the hotel, and they sang at a restaurant. And when pizza was delivered, they sang to the pizza delivery man.
They're just that eager to grace people with their talents?
Well, I think it's something we've established because we don't have a lot of places to perform. I like to stretch them any way I can. So that's just become part of our choir trips, that when I ask them to sing, they do it.
Their dedication to their craft has earned this small choir from a small school honors and recognition, especially over the past few years.
We have gone to state 4 times, and each time we've gotten a superior rating, which is as high as you can get. And it is, I think it's amazing because they are competing with kids in the huge schools in Anchorage. And, you know, the judging is the same for them as for the choirs that have hundreds of kids to pick from.
For state this year, the Tenalian Choir chose the choral ensemble Emerald Stream by Seth Houston. We'll let them take us out this week. You can find this and past episodes of Bristol Band Beyond at our website, kdlg.org. We appreciate that feedback and those story ideas, and we hope you keep it coming. Send an email to dave@kdlg.org or give us a call here at the station anytime. My thanks to the KDLG news team of Lawrence Hamilton, Nick Shalino, and Avery Lill. I'm Dave Benninger. We'll see you back here next week.
Come now and gather in the glade where the emerald stream and the evening shade, and meditate on the words he has made, great God, our sovereign Lord. Join us now, the meadow is green, and the waters pure, and the woods serene, and the flowing air is fresh and clean, where God his blessings poured. Feel the wind come down, hear it whistle as it goes, it brings us song. The sun comes up, and the sun goes down, and the stars move round and round, in witness to his love. Hear now, ye sons of men, for danger lurks in this great garden. The Lord will visit once again to see what we have done. Shepherd, and we are the sheep. We are Mother Earth must keep. Maintain the air, protect the deep. At judgment day he'll come.
See the Lord come down, hear him whistle as he goes. He bears
Support for KDLG comes from Silver Bay Seafoods, a fisherman-owned integrated processor of salmon for domestic and export markets. Job opportunities and more at silverbayseafoods.com.